You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're continuing our coverage of Proposition 50, which voters resoundingly approved moments after polls closed last night. In a moment, we'll be joined by longtime voter data expert and redistricting consultant Paul Mitchell, who drafted the congressional maps in Prop 50. But first, I want to welcome Republican strategist Mike Madrid, who worked on the No on Prop 50 campaign and is the author of The Latino Century, How America's Largest Minority is Transforming Democracy. Welcome back, Mike. Thanks for taking the time.
Always a pleasure to be with you.
So what's the big takeaway for you from last night's results so far?
California or nationally or both?
California. Let's start with Prop 50.
Well, look, this was a resounding defeat. It overperformed most of the polling by 6 or 7 points. What you saw, I think, was a real miss on the enthusiasm that Democrats and independents with a massive break have had to kind of vote against Donald Trump with their middle finger for the first time in 10 months, and they certainly seized the opportunity to do that. You also, at least from my understanding, at least nationally, I haven't looked too closely at California, there seems to be a slightly depressed Republican turnout, Republican base. So even with those who are fully Donald Trump, those precincts were showing a little bit of a drop-off in terms of turnout and support. So big night for partisan Democrats.
Yeah. I mean, you advised on the No on Prop 50 campaign. So Monday morning, quarterbacking just a bit, were there missed opportunities leading up to election night?
Well, look, this was never going to turn out any way other than, I think, a victory for the yes side. It is still California. It's still very partisan. I was a little bit disappointed, not just in the No campaign, but on the yes campaign as well. It just seemed like a retread of both Republican and Democratic messaging, which I guess kind of makes sense for Democrats. But, you know, Democrats have been slipping with voters for the better part of a decade. I think they're just starting to realize that. And they're probably convinced that this will be a retrenchment back, making the same mistakes they did in 2018. For the No side, there's been no adjustment to really kind of understand what is driving some of the sentiment of disaffection from working class voters, from younger voters, from Latino voters. And so without providing a message, you end up defending Donald Trump, which is kind of kryptonite in California, not kind of completely. And that's why I think you saw the drubbing that you saw.
You focus heavily, of course, on the Latino vote. What does turnout currently look like, the Latino vote on Prop 50?
Well, it's a little bit lower than non-Hispanic voters, but it always is. You'll have to talk to Paul in the next segment about what I think the full numbers are and what they look like. But you asked the right question. There's in my mind, as somebody's watching Latino vote kind of change over time and kind of it's predicting a lot of these dramatic shifts we've seen in recent years, it's not that a lot of Latinos have returned, or I should say moved away from the Republican Party. And that's a very methodical, deliberate way of saying it. These voters are not Democrat-based voters anymore, but they are very much anti-Republican, the same way they were anti-Democratic in November of last year. This is a de-alignment. It's a lot of people have kind of considered this rightward shift of Hispanics as a racial realignment. I've always rejected that. There's no evidence to suggest that. There's overwhelming evidence to suggest that Latinos are rejecting both parties in greater and greater numbers. And this is more evidence of that. This is exactly what that signifies. So turnout matters because if you see turnout getting worse, what it means is people are just checking out completely from the process. I think the raw numbers are higher than they've been in a very long time, especially for a special election. But the gap between Latino voters and non-Latino voters remains a persistent problem that we've got to pay attention to and not dismiss anymore. We've been dismissing it for a long time. And then the other question in my mind is does this partisan break get to 2018 numbers, the same numbers that you saw with Trump, his first midterms? And it doesn't look like we're anywhere near that range at the moment.
Well, more Latinos voted for Trump for his second presidency back in 2024. And just taking a look at just some early returns, some of the Latino majority districts that swung more conservative just last year in 2024 are voting yes on Prop 50 or are very split. You have districts in the Central Valley, Fresno, also Monterey in the Central Coast, Riverside down in Southern California. A year isn't that long, especially when it comes to politics. Do you think it's the policies of the second Trump administration that have really shaped the change in perhaps voting behavior for Latinos from 1 year to the next, potentially?
I think it's a number of things. It's certainly that, but I want to really challenge the assumption of the question. I don't think that Latino voters were voting for Donald Trump as much as they were not voting for Kamala Harris. And there's a very big difference there. That's foundationally why people, I think, don't understand this vote and why they keep making the same mistakes in assuming that they're proactively voting for some agenda. As the largest ethnic group in the country, Latinos are basically, last election cycle, basically evenly split. But where most people would look at it and say, you know, half of Latinos are voting for Republicans, half are voting for Democrats, my perspective is half of Latinos are voting against Republicans and the other half are voting against Democrats. And when you understand it that way, the turnout problem and the weak partisan anchor that our community has really starts to come into context. You look at these really wide swings that happened like in Imperial County or in Passaic County, New Jersey, or in Manassas, Virginia. These massive swings towards Republicans 10 months ago and swings back, this is not an aberration. This is the swings are getting bigger and wider, and this trend has been evident, clear for over a decade. So at a certain point, like, we've got to stop our old ways of looking at these voters through a partisan lens and start realizing that something foundationally different is happening here.
How should Republicans rethink their strategy coming out of this election, not only in California, but the other elections in other states? I mean, it was a win for Democrats last night.
Well, it was a rout for Democrats. But then, look, I mean, this is kind of the advice I've been giving to no audience in the Republican Party for three decades. I mean, one of the great ironies of Tuesday night last night was, if Donald Trump had just gone golfing and took the inherited economy he got from Joe Biden, already course correcting, and not felt the need to do anything in terms of militarizing our streets and cracking down on those that are here undocumented, he'd probably be sitting at a 57, 58 support level, and this would have been a very different night, but he can't. And there's no courage in the Republican Party to stand up and say, this is clearly bad politics, it's bad morally, and it's bad economically. And when you have a party that's essentially devolved into just a fealty test, this should not be a surprising result. So that's the long answer. The short answer is, whichever party is able to get back to a working class aspirational economic message is going to be dominant for the next generation. But neither party has shown any proclivity to be moving in that direction. None.
Finally, bringing it back to Prop 50, as drafted, is meant to be temporary, 6 years, three election cycles. Do you believe that the Independent Redistricting Commission will come back?
No, of course not. Certainly not in its old form. I mean, you're not going to have these members just kind of give this up. There will be another excuse. There will be another crisis. It may be, you know, maybe that we come up with something better, but is it going to stay the same? And like, this is just the way we're going to do things? No, absolutely not.
Do you think the lawsuit that was recently filed by Republicans, including the California Republican Party, is viable, challenging the constitutionality of Prop 50?
Look, I'm not a lawyer, and I'm not even aware of the merits of it, but I doubt it. I doubt it. This is voter approved. I mean, like, unless it's blatantly unconstitutional, which it doesn't seem to be. I mean, I don't know what the merits of the case would be to suggest that it's not legal. So no, I don't think there's anything to it.
All right, Mike, thanks as always for taking the time.
You bet, Vicky. Thanks for having me.
Mike Madrid is a Republican strategist who worked on the No on Prop 50 campaign and is the author of The Latino Century, How America's Largest Minority is Transforming Democracy. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I now want to welcome longtime voter data expert and redistricting consultant Paul Mitchell, who drafted the congressional maps in Prop 50. Welcome, Paul.
Thanks for having me.
So did last night meet expectations?
Well, it depends on what your expectations were being set. So on election day, I think most people thought that with the polling and how stable it had been, and then looking at the voter turnout that we were seeing and tracking in the weeks leading up to election day, that was what we expected. We expected it to win, you know, 62% seems a little higher than probably expectations were, but ultimately it's the same difference. I mean, we thought that it was going to win pretty strongly, over 10-point advantage for sure. if you would ask me this when we last talked, or, you know, when we first started this process, I would say no. It was kind of a joke among my staff. Evan McLaughlin, who's kind of my number two in redistricting partners on a lot of these congressional things, I would say to him almost every day as we were doing this, this isn't real. This isn't going to happen, right? This is never going to happen. This is just a drill. For a long time, we thought we were kind of running a bluff on Texas. Our entire goal was to try to stop Texas from doing what they were doing. And the transition to something that was going to be real, something that might be put on the ballot, getting it, you know, on the ballot to the legislature, all those things were seemingly insurmountable hurdles at the time. So I think from the 3-month viewpoint, this is pretty astonishing. But from the 24-hour viewpoint, it's what it ended up where it was going to land.
Yeah, this special election spanned, you know, just over 70 days, I think just shy of 11 weeks. I mean, turnout is still taking shape. But for the election results that you've seen so far, what stands out to you so far about voter turnout for a special election like this?
So voter turnout, we always expected to be around 50%-ish, and I think that's what it's going to end up being. We were seeing in the early data that the turnout was extremely partisan, so not a lot of independents were voting, a lot more Democrats and Republicans. We also saw a Democratic turnout advantage in these numbers, which was greater than like the 24 general election advantage. A part of that, it sounds kind of silly, but you know, the No Kings protests, we saw huge push of additional mailed-in ballots right after that No Kings protest, to the point where the number of ballots that had come in as of like the Wednesday before the election was higher than the 2024 general election had the Wednesday before the election. So, you know, there was definitely a lot of organizing and interest on the Democratic side. And then something that Mikey had mentioned was potentially drop-off of Republican turnout. I think it's important for people who are going to kind of look at this election in the rearview mirror to recognize that the no side spent, you know, tens of millions of dollars mailing voters even before the bill was passed by the legislature, and then went completely dark in the last 10 days. It's the opposite of what you would expect in a campaign, especially when the data suggested Republicans were likely to turn out at the end or in person on Election Day, and they were getting zero messaging from TV or digital. There was just essentially the campaign had hung it up, and that might have kind of depressed turnout on the Republican side at the end when you would expect there to be a big kind of Republican surge. And that probably is the difference between this being something that passes, you know, 57-43 to something that might pass 60-40 or 61-39 or something.
I'm curious what your thoughts and responses to the argument out there from people like Mike Madrid, who just said that they don't believe that independent redistricting commission, which is a gold standard in the country, will be coming back in the same, at least in the same way that it existed. What is your confidence level that this redrawing of the maps will last as written 6 years?
Well, I love Mikey. Madrid and I have been friends since college, but he's wrong on that. I think anybody saying that the commission isn't going to come back hasn't read the ballot measure. The ballot measure institutes this plan for 3 cycles and goes away. What is left in the Constitution is the Independent Redistricting Commission, every aspect of it. Nothing has been touched. And so what would it take to do this again? It would take another huge statewide ballot measure. Voters, when you ask them, do they want to get rid of the Redistricting Commission? Support was at 12%. So nobody wants to get rid of the Redistricting Commission. The only way this passed was because it was this existential crisis and it was temporary. I don't know how you could go back to voters in 4 or 5 years and say, hey, the commission hasn't even drawn new lines, but we want to do another temporary one because of some other new existential crisis. Voters would not buy that, and I would not be drawing maps for that. This is a one-time thing, and I think it was probably a good message for the no side to try to stir up the fear that it would be permanent. And I understand that people who watch government, if the government says, oh, we're going to suspend this law for 5 years and bring it back in the future, kind of know they're never going to do that. But this is a different scenario. It would take another $100 million campaign, and voters just wouldn't buy it.
So the last time you joined us, you said you wouldn't do this again. You know, this was a unique scenario. So is there any existential crisis scenario where that answer would change?
Somebody asked me this last night, and I came up with one. And that is, if California secedes from the country and we have to develop a new Congress or legislative branch for the state of California, I'd be happy to draw those lines. But no, there's just not a, there's not a scenario where I see myself back at the, drawing maps. Now, if let's say not this VRA lawsuit, I don't think this VRA lawsuit's going anywhere, but if the VRA is thrown out by the Supreme Court and they have to draw new lines, it would probably be drawn by special masters by a court. And sure, I would probably draw lines and submit it to the court as submission or something like that. But that's different than me like controlling the pen in the relationship we had with the redistricting that happened this time.
Should mid-decade redistricting be banned after this?
Absolutely. And it, with the caveat that sometimes you do have court decisions and things like that. So New York State, we did the redistricting for the State Redistricting Commission, and then there was a court case, and then we had to go back and redo it. And there's nothing, inherently bad about that. But yes, the idea of legislatures being able to kind of snap their fingers and draw new lines, I don't think that that's something that we should continue going forward. That's not the way to, have a clean democratic process, that before every election we're going to kind of, shake up the Etch-a-Sketch and redraw districts to suit whatever party's in power. So the answer is yes. And I think the further answer is that we do need national reform to create independent redistricting commissions of the California-Michigan model around the country. Redistricting commissions where they are appointed not by the politicians, but by an independent panel. They are bipartisan. They work together on drafting lines that don't go back to the legislature for approval, that go straight into being implemented. They use the criteria like the State Redistricting Commission has. It is the best model for a state, a city, a county, even a local redistricting like a school board. And it takes the politics out of the process and creates an opportunity for a government structure that voters can have more trust in. And I 100% embrace. And I think that we might have an opportunity where Charles Munger supports this, Gavin Newsom supports this. I think we might have people who come out of this horrific national redistricting drama who will say, we never want to do this again. We might have momentum to put together a clean bill nationally to implement national redistricting reform. I think that would be the ultimate thing that I'd like to see.
And that drama isn't over. Are you advising other states who are weighing whether they should redraw their own lines ahead of the midterms?
No, I've done work in Virginia and Colorado that are two states that are potentially being looked at. But I'm not advising any of the national folks. There are national people who do a lot of this redistricting, and they were kind enough to kind of let me, the California guy, come in and help with this process for our Prop 50 maps. But I'm not going to elbow my way into their work. They're excellent, and I'm sure they'll do everything they can.
Finally, this special election is kind of odd and unique in that it's like a pit stop to the midterm, which will be here before we know it. I mean, as a data geek, an election expert, what are you interested in seeing develop and evolve in, the not too many months we have until the next election day?
Yeah, it's interesting because when you step back, it's almost like the recall election, where the recall election was like a pit stop to the 2022 gubernatorial election. And it did have its footprint on the actual 2022 general election. You saw, as an example, the Republican Party had kind of exhausted a lot of their resources in the recall and then just really didn't have a substantial campaign in 2022. So I don't know that that's exactly what's going to happen, but I do think that the 26 primary will have elements to it that we can point back to and look at what we had here. And, as an example, Democrats are extremely energized. They're organized. I think a lot of them feel like the wind is at their back again. They have a message of fighting back against Trump that if you'd asked Democrats 4 months ago, the Democratic registered voters, they would say, well, my party likes to write sternly worded memos and give a long speech. That was the most they thought their party could do. And this shows them that their party can do more. And so this might have a ripple effect going into 26, where Democrats have now, done a speed run of the organizing capacity they're going to need to, flip these new seats and go into 2026 with real motivation. And we see not just in California, but around the country, you know, Democrats did very well. And I'm not speaking as a partisan. I'm speaking more just as like looking at the landscape of what we're seeing around the country. And this is true if it was a Democratic president and Republicans were winning races in the midterms, we'd be saying the opposite thing. So it's kind of the lay of the land in the country right now.
I mean, given that you've been relied upon in nonpartisan redistricting for years, what do you say to someone who thinks you're professionally partisan now? I mean, you did dip into a partisan fight.
Yeah. So I was called upon to do this, and I did it in a way that we tried to maintain as many of like the core values of how California does redistricting. I think we've talked about it before. You know, we're now facing a lawsuit because we followed the Voting Rights Act. We kept cities and counties together. We protected communities of interest. It was really amazing to see like Cal Poly Pomona came out with a study that said that we created districts that help strengthen Latino voting power. And the Asian Studies Center at UCLA said this helps strengthen Asian voting power. And groups like the NAACP endorsed our maps. The, you know, groups that generally would be opposed to this, like Common Cause, had a thing that showed that their checklist of good redistricting practices were followed in the work that we did. So I can say that, yes, we participated in this because of an existential crisis, but we did our best to bring values, good values, to this redistricting process. And I've got, for this one process, I've got over 150 redistrictings I've done around the country that have been nonpartisan. I've helped stand up independent redistricting commissions. I've been an advocate for this. And I think that, you know, in 5 years when I'm back just doing the local school board redistricting or, you know, San Joaquin County redistricting, it's going to fall right back into the work we were doing 5 years ago.
Paul, thanks for stopping by.
Thanks for having me.
Paul Mitchell is a longtime voter data expert and redistricting consultant who drafted the congressional maps in Prop 50, which voters approved. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.